Hello, everyone. Thank you for watching another episode of The Naturalist Capitalist. I hope you're all having a good night. I sure am. I've got Scott Horton on the other end. How you doing tonight, Scott?
I'm doing great. Good to be with you.
So the first question I got to ask you, is there a warrant out for your arrest right now? Because
I hope not.
I saw you
Possibly
murder.
for some parking tickets.
Well, I saw you murder someone on live TV on a stage, and I was wondering if you got away with it. I'm talking about Billy Crystal, of course, or Bill Crystal, not the actor, but
No, that was fun. And thank you. I'm glad you considered it a win. I was worried that I would. I mean, well, boy, I better turn this audio down here. I knew that I would win, but the question was by how much and whether I would make y'all proud or whether you'd be like, meh, it was all right, kind of thing. So I'm glad I didn't let y'all down, man.
yeah, I,
I hate
when I
that song, bitch, too.
when I was watching, I would have been embarrassed if I were Bill because, I mean, he just didn't seem like he had anything prepared. Literally, did he have notes? I don't even remember because he seemed to
Yeah, he
just
did.
like
He
kind
had
of.
a yeah, he had a folder full of things. And when I started talking, he started taking notes. I could see him out of my peripheral vision there, kind of busily writing things down. And then somewhere in that first, in my first opening thing, he just quit. He put his pen down, he quit taking notes. And then I've had a couple of people say to me on rewatching, I've actually only seen the thing once. I need to go back and watch it. But I've been told a couple of times that that was when he gave up, was right then. But he kind of was like, okay, well, I'm just gonna go back to my bromides. I'm not gonna try to like counter these points, which to be fair to him, I was being unfair in a way where I just pummeled him with so many points that he couldn't possibly respond to them all. So that kind of gave him the opportunity to just kind of ignore the things I said and just go, well, that's the way you see it. You know what I mean? Without having to really engage it. But the thing is, I mean, I knew going in there, this is Bill Crystal that we're talking about. So he's always completely aloof. You know what I mean? He doesn't care what anybody says. Code Pink ladies have screamed war criminal at him 500 times, dude. He doesn't care. You know what I
Right.
mean? So I knew I wasn't going to be able to move him at all. So I might as well, win the debate for the audience and, hopefully score some points on the point, really, to the audience about the efficacy of interventionism, whether or not Bill Crystal was the one I was beating up on there. But just, all these wars that he and a lot of other people supported, they haven't really worked out as advertised. And, it was Dave that pointed out, and he was kind about it, but I really dropped the ball on at one point in the questions and answers when one of the questioners said, well, can you name one of these that you stand by that's a success after all this time? And he went back to 1994 in the Balkans. And then I debunked that and said, actually, it was the American ambassador that ruined the peace deal there, that caused that to happen. That's not the point. Or I could have made that without details. I could have said that really quickly. And the real point was, wow, everybody, did you hear that? He's not willing to even stand by Kosovo, much
Right.
less Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Somalia at all. The entire 21st century, forget it. According to Bill Crystal, his magazine, The Weekly Standard, were major ringleaders of the push for the war in Kosovo in 99 as well. Justin used to always claim that it was Crystal who said this. It wasn't actually Crystal. He was the editor of the magazine, but it was somebody else in the Weekly Standard who wrote, it's time to crack Serb skulls in this war. And that was, he wouldn't even stand by that. Iraq, Libya, Syria, Afghanistan, which we just left. He couldn't say, well, I think Afghanistan, Obama just ended the surge too soon. If only we'd stayed and done better, we could have won by 2016 and things would be fine. Right? Like he could have come up with some line, but
Yeah.
he didn't even try to come up with some line about any one of the 21st century wars at all. And I really, I was too distracted looking at my notes of the points to refute on the smaller scale and was missing like the big picture. Like, wow, what an admission by him. That, at one point he did say, yeah, Iraq was probably a mistake, which that was huge. And I don't think he's ever admitted that before. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think he's ever said that before. But this was better than that, even. This was him refusing to stand by any of them of this century at all. So that to me is pretty, profound when he was the ringleader of them all. Who could stand for all these wars if Bill Kristol can't anymore? You know?
Yeah. So did you get a lot of feedback from people who have seen it who were not already in your camp? Did you move anybody that you know of, or has anyone messaged you or emailed you?
I don't think I've gotten any messages from people who had their mind changed by the thing, but I've been told by people that they showed it to people and changed their mind with it. And I was told that one guy told me this story that the lady sitting behind him was on a blind date, or not a blind date, but was on a date and had been stood up. So she didn't even know what she was doing there or who was even on. So he goes, well, you know, the fat guy's the bad guy and this other guy's going to beat up on him for us. So, you know, check it out. You'll have a good time anyway. So she stayed and watched and apparently was impressed, you know. So I got a few of those. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody said to me, I really was on Crystal's side, but now I'm not anymore. But, you know, this was one of Gene's frustrations is he kept trying to get Bill Kristol to retweet the thing because this is his hometown. And there are, you know, he's not really a leader of right-wing hawks anymore. People, you know, the right-wingers don't like him anymore.
Yeah, right.
But he is a champion of center left liberals, you know, now that he's like this anti-Trump Hillary Clintonite type, you know, where he moved one click back to the left. Does that make him a neoliberal? You know, it's funny because Bill Kristol technically is only a neoconservative by association because his father used to be a commie, but Bill was never a commie. Bill was raised as a, you know, on the right.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's moving a click to the left. Anyway, point is that, there should be some New Yorker folk who think of him as some great hero for the last 5 years or whatever, who are trying to ignore the last 20. But I'm not certain if he had any people in the audience at all. I think he alluded to the idea that there may be some there, but I don't know that he was certain that he definitely had friends who showed up there for him. And he didn't do anything to promote it. And that would have been better. I would have preferred to have a bunch of hawks and a bunch of objectivists and a bunch of, right, you know, people who are used to taking his side, pro-Zionist types, and then see if I can really change their minds. You know what I mean? Because I came in there with such a super majority already supporting me that, I mean, whatever, I still beat him anyway, but on the numbers, it wasn't as impressive. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I would have really preferred to see a bunch of people, if that's possible, I don't know, but if it was possible, it would have been nice to see a proportion of the audience really change their mind from hawks to not, you know. But
yeah, I mean, it seems like the Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, they're losing a lot of support, but I don't know really anyone or very few people who think that Vietnam was a good choice. So it seems like the more time that gets in between us and some dumb war that we fought, the more people end up just admitting that it was dumb. So do you think that in 30 years, everybody is going to think these wars were dumb, or what's your thought on that?
Well, it's already, I mean, super majorities already said we should have never done Iraq or Afghanistan at all. And that includes the soldiers. And according to the Pew poll of 2019, the soldiers and previous polls as well, and the soldiers say that in higher numbers than the rest of the population, that we never should have fought them at all. And so that's pretty significant. And I think people know, I mean, how old were you at the time? Like, yeah, Iraq War II, 2003?
9.
Oh, yeah. So you're a kid. But, yeah, you know, for people who are adults during that time at all, man, they were relentless for a year and a half. Saddam is going to give the most dangerous weapons in the world, sarin, nerve gas, and maybe nuclear bombs to terrorists who attack this country. And we have to launch this preemptive war to protect the American people from weapons of mass destruction. They could nuke you in your jammies. You are in danger. For a year and a half, they beat us over the head with that. And then as soon as they got there, they went weapons of mass destruction. No, this is Operation
Iraqi Freedom. Yeah.
they originally named it, no lie, Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL. And then they were like, oh, geez, I guess we better fix that. When they meant to name it, you know, I wish I was smart enough to come up with a good Israel acronym right now. But anyway, Iraqi Freedom. And now it's just all about democracy and all of that. So people remember, even the pro-war side, I think they cringed a little bit during that. You know what I mean? They're like, man, you really did say this whole thing about how they might kill my mom. And now you're telling me that, like, man, no, it's all just charity. You know, charity for Arabs. We're going to redo, remake their society because we love them so much. Where it just doesn't ring true to people, you know? It wasn't true. And then, but at the time, of course, the left half of America was right on this stuff. So the right wingers were wrong and refused to admit it, refused to concede. And even, you know, Ron Paul helped, but it really wasn't until Trump got up there and started pushing Jeb around and calling him a loser for being brothers with George, that that was finally, I mean, think of it. They nominated McCain in 08 and Romney in 12. They would not break from the Bush legacy until right. Trump got up there and like pushed Jeb down on the playground. Like, you're a loser because your brother's a loser, you loser. And then, you know, because that was how he made, which he did it. And it was perfect. And I loved it. And that's the thing I love about Trump the most was the way he just absolutely bullied the crap out of Jeb and Hillary and treated them like trash. You know, your husband's a rapist. Whoa. All right. Now we're playing ball. You know what I mean? That's mm-hmm. presidential politics, you know, the way I like it. And the way he destroyed Jeb Bush and used W. Bush as the albatross to hang around his neck, you know. So that was what really, you know, changed the mind of the right and made them willing to admit that, you know, that made it okay for them to admit that this was all wrong. You know, I'm rambling, but I gave a speech to the Republican Liberty Caucus in Corpus Christi probably 2 years ago. Great group of guys down there. And the whole way down, I just couldn't get my head around like what kind of speech I wanted to give and what I wanted to say and whatever. In fact, my idea was I would give them a speech about how to attack the right from the right and phrase all this stuff for Republicans and all that. But what am I, an idiot? I was going in front of a group of Republicans. I should have just gone up there and attacked the right from the right, not give them a speech about that, but go up there and give them the most right-wing anti-war speech I can. That's yep. the job, dummy. So instead of getting up there and starting with Donald Trump says going to the Middle East is the worst decision any American president ever made. Donald Trump says we already lost the Afghan war and we should get out of there now. Donald Trump says all this stuff, and boy, is he right about that. And thank goodness for the, you know, Trump breaking from the Bush legacy, and get the crowd on my side with that. And instead, I didn't do that. And one guy who had had a few to drink, I think, got really pissed off because his son was over there in Afghanistan or had been or something, and got up and wanted to fight me and was like, how dare you contact the war and whatever. Well, he was not right, but he was right that I didn't do it right. I should have got up there and attacked the right from the right and said, this is why the Republican Party must be the anti-war party now. That Donald Trump, this is his key insight that makes him so great, you know, compared to the others and whatever like that, to appeal to that sentiment in them, because that's what it was that led them to this. But then here's the point, Reed, is that it's true, right? The war was a disaster. All the wars have been a disaster. We should have never done a regime change in Kabul and tried to create a new government in Afghanistan. We sure as hell should not have sent the 3rd Infantry Division, the entire goddamn Marine Corps, into Iraq the way that they did. And then not only that, but knock off the government, de-Ba'athify everything, take the Shiite side in a 5-year civil war. I mean, holy, how could anybody now, other than John Bolton, just sit there and go, I still like it. Yeah, right. No one else will dare say, yes, the Iraq war was a good idea, because they couldn't add another sentence to the end of that. They couldn't keep talking and elaborate. You know, they might say, what are they going to say? Well, it's a democracy. Yeah, for the Shiite supermajority under the thumb of the Iranians, who are, you know, total chauvinists and lord it over their conquered Sunni former countrymen, you know, and commit the massive war crimes against them for, you know, this whole time still. And leaving this unresolved mess in this country. You know what I mean? There's nothing to argue for it. Yeah. People gave their best friend. People lost their legs and their buddy in the big battle for Ramadi. And then what did they get out of it? You know, what did they get out? They got nothing out of it, and they know it. There's no way. You can't point at Ramadi and go, well, there's a Disneyland there now. Aren't you so happy that we went to give these people a democracy and turn him into a Western country or whatever was the lie. We tracked down the September 11th master planners in Iraq. No, they weren't there. Wrong country, you know? So anybody who was there, people who were, all they knew at the time was hoorah. They know better than that now. It's unavoidable, right? Donald Trump, the reason that it worked when he bullied Jeb Bush is because he was right. If it had been the other way around and Jeb Bush was trying to bully Donald Trump and go, you didn't even support the war, that wouldn't have worked.
Right.
That would have never worked, you know? And it was just too late for that. And so...
So I got a question for you about right wing, or you can finish your point if you got something else. But
well, I was just going to say, you know, we can welcome back the Vietnam syndrome, you know, what our government called this mental illness of the American people's reluctance to go overseas and fight these no-win wars in other people's countries where we don't belong, trying to prop up this dictator in power or that one against the wishes of their own people. And with occupying troops like Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan like this, it's bananas. Who in the world, you mentioned Vietnam, who in the world could have believed in Afghanistan and Iraq after Vietnam? Well, who could believe in any one of these ever again after Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq now? You know, there's just no way that you could stand by this and say, no, we just need to try again harder in Iran or whatever it is. So I say bring on Iraq War Syndrome and celebrate it. We're not supposed to be an empire anyway. We'll leave these other countries alone to solve their own problems internally their own way.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general that there is a sentiment that's building. Like you said, a super majority of people disapprove of all this stuff. But it's mostly past tense. I feel like in the present tense, when something happens, a lot of these people forget all of that. When Trump airstriked Soleimani, I mean, I'm not just talking about Republican legislators or like people in Congress. My Republican friends were banging the war drums, like my hardcore Trump Republican, you know, redneck dudes or whatever. They all wanted to, you know, just go in and wipe Iran clean off the map. And then with Joe Biden pulling out of Afghanistan a few months ago, same thing. It was like, oh, this is such a disaster. We should have stayed there longer. And, you know, had a better investment or had a better return on our investment. You know, we just should have done more. We should have, you know, left troops there or whatever. So, like, it seems like when they see something in the past, they can realize it was a mistake. But whenever something is happening in the present tense, it just goes right over their heads. Do you think that's true or do you think they're starting to catch on with that, too?
Well, no, I mean, I think in the main, that's correct. You know, right wingers like being macho and kicking ass and. You mess with us, you get beat down. That's how it goes, you know. And then I don't know why in the world they always believe what they're told by the same TV that lies to them about every other thing. But they say, oh, the Ayatollah's going to get you. And they're willing to go with that. They're willing to believe in that. And look, you know what? I mean, I have to admit, dude, that, you know, I was 15 at the time. And I supported Iraq War One. And my parents were not hawks, you know, they're not Republicans and they were not hawks on the war. They don't like that kind of stuff. Like they aren't hardcore against it or anything, but they weren't for it. Mm-hmm. But I was because I'm a boy, you know, I like supersonic jets and tanks and explosions. And the bigger the explosion, the better. And if you really ask ninth grade me to try to care at all about the fate of Iraqi civilians, you might as well be asking me about the right of fire ants, and not only like fire ants in my yard, but fire ants in Louisiana or whatever. I don't care what you do to them. It doesn't matter. What matters is I like explosions and loud noises and stuff. You know, I don't know, heavy equipment. You're a truck driver, you understand.
Yeah. You'd like, you know? My job. Yeah
so yeah, it's, you know, it's exciting. And so, you know, if you're a right winger and that, in a sense, you know, it seems to include like a certain degree of denial of humanity of the rest of the people of the planet, where it's really only America. It's a really kind of weird sort of nationalism, or not weird, I don't know. It's an ugly kind of nationalism that, and they teach this in school. You know, we have rights because of the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights. Well, the rest of the world, they don't have that. So that means they don't have rights. So that means it's okay to bomb them, you know, and they don't, you know, they don't always explain it quite that simply, but pretty much like that's how it goes. And this is especially true when I was a kid. I don't know if it's exactly like this now, but it was really like this a lot when I was a kid. Like overseas, there was a plane crash. 26 Americans were killed. And they wouldn't even say how many other people were even on the plane or also died at all. They wouldn't get a mention at all. Yeah. You know, they that really do crash, make it.
By the way, like, that's still exactly the same, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, so there's just, and you know what? I can never find this clip, Reed. And world, I apologize if I got this wrong, but I'm 99.999% sure this exists. And it's not the same clip where it's Nixon and Kissinger. And I think it's Kissinger. It might be Haldeman or something. I could swear it's Kissinger. I have the Nixon tapes. I need to go back and find this somewhere. But it's not where they're talking about nuking Vietnam. It's a different clip than that. But it's Nixon says something like, look, man, you have to understand that I'm a president and I deal on the level of a leader of a state with other leaders of states. Civilian casualties in other countries, that's just below my purview. Like, that just doesn't matter. It's a separate level of morality. People killing people, that's one thing. But I am a statesman. And so it's different. I can kill a few million people, you know? He just goes on to explain. That's just the outlook. And I think a lot of Americans do have that outlook. And boy, TV's told us that we hate Iran for 40 years straight, and we never have carpet bombed that country. So you could see how, like, there's a little bit of feeling of, like, pent-up aggression here. The Ayatollah is Hitler, but we never do anything about him. Don't you think it's time that we do? And then it's such an easy thing to answer yes. You know, what are you, Neville Chamberlain giving in to Hitler at Munich? Come on, it's time to stop appeasing and start being a man and standing up for truth and justice and righteousness. And then those narratives are very simple to sell, very easy to sell. And you're right that it's shameful, too, that it, especially at this point, we ought to be way past can't get fooled again on this stuff. You know, how could anybody think? Well, I mean, just reason it out. If the Ayatollah is so bad, how come we haven't gone to war with them this whole time then? How come W. Bush refused to bomb him when Dick Cheney tried to convince him to do it? You know, and the answer is there's nothing to fight him for. In fact, W. Bush complains in his memoirs. Oh, man, when the CIA came out with their national intelligence estimate verifying that Iran only had a civilian nuclear program and not a nuclear weapons program, well, that took all my military options off the table. How was I supposed to take military action against a country when my own intelligence services say they're not making nuclear weapons? I can't. Damn CIA for telling the truth that one time. You know? And that's the reality of it. By the way, 100 times better than this interview of me, no offense to you, is Jeff Dice's interview of Dan McAdams. And there's a brand new one on the Mises podcast of Daniel McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute. And he's Ron Paul's foreign policy guy for the last 20 years, co-host of the Liberty Report, of course. And they just had the greatest episode. It's so good. And one of the things they talk about is the threat of Iran. And McAdams is just like, get out of here with this. You know, yeah, the Ayatollah, he goes, yeah, the Ayatollah's been making nukes for 30 years. Boy, I guess he's on a really long coffee break because he never seems to get around to finally ever finishing a single one. Yeah, you know, it's because it's just not true. The whole thing is a hoax. It always has been, as he says, an Israeli-centered hoax. You know, they have their panic attacks and we're supposed to appease them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... It's weird how war has kind of evolved throughout the ages. I mean, back in the day, there used to be these giant superpowers fighting each other, like World War II. And then we got nukes and we had so much technology that it was going to be disastrous if we start fighting each other face to face. So then we start doing all these proxy wars like Vietnam and then eventually what we're doing in the Middle East. But something that I've really realized with the pullout from Afghanistan, we might have removed the ground troops, but we still have the what's it called? The over the horizon approach there, which is targeted drone strikes, which, as we just saw on the news like a couple months ago, it killed 7 innocent children and civilians. And it seems like that is going to be the next style of warfare. Even though we're still doing the boots on the ground, a lot of these countries, it seems like that's what we're moving toward. Do you think that's true? And do you think it'll be harder for the public to see through that?
Yes, but not in Afghanistan. So let me just say, I was optimistic about this. I think I called this right back, you know, if you go back to the beginning of August or even, you know, earlier in June, July, that Biden says he wants an over the horizon capacity. But just do a geography check. You know, the Russians are not, they've already said hell no to bases in Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, any of those. And they have the sway there to say yes or no. Obviously, we can't put bases in Iran. And then, so it all comes down to Imran Khan and his government in Pakistan. And are the Pakistanis going to let us have a drone base there to fly missions against ISIS or whoever in Afghanistan? And I think the answer to that is no. And that leaves us with, you know, long-range bombers flying out of Qatar, or, you know, possibly, I guess possibly aircraft carriers in the Indian Ocean, but I'm not certain their range, and they got to fly over the Hindu, or not the Hindu Kush, but whichever giant mountain range, I forgot the name of it, there on the Afghan-Pakistan border there. You know, when we go by land from the port of Karachi, you got to go all the way up to the Khyber Pass before you can take a left and get into Afghanistan, because there's a giant mountain range in the way there. And I know that really cuts down on the range of the F-18s flying from aircraft carriers in the Indian Ocean there. So I think when they do whatever strikes they do in Afghanistan, they can only launch them from Qatar. And it's just not very effective. They have essentially no intelligence on the ground. ISIS in Afghanistan is the Taliban's problem now. And my bet is that the Taliban will solve it quite readily. And probably they will overdo it and you know, be pretty brutal about it. But I don't think, you know, what we call ISIS in Afghanistan now are essentially Pakistani refugees of Obama's drone war there in 2010. And they came just like the Afghan Taliban would seek safe haven on the Pakistani side of the border. These are Pakistani Taliban who are seeking safe haven on the Afghan side of the border. So then the Afghan government intelligence service, the NDS, and I don't know that the CIA was involved in this read, but I can only presume that they were, because the NDS is nothing but an agency of the CIA, essentially, the National, or NSD, National Security Directorate. They work directly for the CIA. So I think it's Osman Bornan. Osman Bornan is the guy that wrote this great article on the origins of ISIS. And he talks about how the CIA was using them and was paying them to attack against, to do attacks against the Pakistani government as revenge for the Pakistani government backing the Afghan Taliban. And then they were also trying to back them against the Afghan Taliban for a while. But then in, I'm going to say 2013, they hoisted the black flag and declared that they were part of ISIS. And then at that point, they made themselves the enemy. And at that point, that gave the Americans an opportunity to ally with the Taliban against these worst bin Ladenite, you know, berserker types, and which they did. And 1 year ago, in the Washington Post, October 2020, Matthew, what's the guy's name? I'm sorry, I forgot. Matthew, what's his name, with the new Afghanistan book, wrote a thing in the Washington Post about how JSOC was flying, as they put it, the Taliban's air force, in flying drones, providing air cover and doing assassination strikes against ISIS targets in conjunction with the Taliban. So I think that's where that's just going to be left. I don't think that they can do this in Afghanistan anymore. I don't think anybody nearby is going to let them. And if they want to launch bases from Qatar, who are they going to bomb? I mean, unless it's the Taliban calling in the airstrike, who do they have on the ground to call in the airstrike? And I just don't think, I think they're going to have to just sit back and hope that the Taliban, that if they do compromise with these people rather than obliterating them, that they make their conditions extremely strong. And by the way, I do think that the Taliban has every reason in the world to live up to their agreement and not support international terrorist groups in that country, and certainly not let them carry out terrorist attacks outside their borders. I think they learned the lesson of that mistake the very, very hard way over 20 years. And the Taliban, regardless of all the propaganda, they never were bin Ladenite, Leninist, revolutionary types. They always were right-wing conservatives, not radicals. And they want their Islamic Emirate and revolution in one country and not this kind of bin Ladenite long-term, long-scale time horizon for revolution throughout the region and all that. It's never been their vision. So they would be giving up everything that they have won, which is everything they ever wanted, in exchange for something that they do not want. And so, and then would be getting the, you know, would be inviting the B-52s back to decimate them and their army again. So I'm pretty sure that they're not going to do anything like that. And when the Hawks say that they still back Al-Qaeda, they're always exaggerating and obfuscating and kind of bait and switching a little bit. And well, the Taliban works very close with the Haqqanis, and the Haqqanis work very close with Lashkar-e-Taiba, and they fight the Indians in Kashmir. So fucking what, right? Like, what, right, what does that have to do with anything? But you're supposed to pretend that that means they're breaking the deal with us and that amounts to supporting Al-Qaeda or something. It's just not really accurate. Now, to your larger question of, is this the future of warfare? Yes, in the sense that, well, look, this goes to show what a racket it all is, okay? Here's the division of labor. The Army and the Air Force are heavily targeting a buildup in Eastern Europe against Russia. The Navy and the Air Force gets around, they want to build up against China and have a Cold War against China in the Pacific. Now, what's the difference? The difference is the Navy doesn't have much of a role in a war against Russia, and the Army doesn't have much of a role in a war against China. So, you know, what would it take for the Army to say, actually, there's not really a threat from Russia? We agree that the Navy and the Air Force should focus on China and we'll just sit out and do nothing, right? Or for the Navy to say, yeah, the Chinese, they're our second biggest trading partner. We love them. We get along with them just fine. We don't need to build up against them. The Army's right. Russia's the real problem. We're going to sit this out and you guys focus on containing the Russians, right? Instead, it's both, because it's just like any other budget deal, that you guys get your money and we get our money, and you get your, you know, bogus make work program and then we get ours. And then you have the Special Operations Command, and the Special Operations Command wants to fly drones and send in, you know, assassination teams, Rangers and Delta and SEALs and whoever, all throughout the Middle East and Africa forever. And especially they're invading Africa. And I have two different quotes in the book, one from the New York Times and one from Defense News, where the military guys in charge say very simply, because they don't know to be ashamed of it, they just go, well, look, now that we're drawing down from Iraq and Afghanistan, we need something to do. So we're looking to go to Africa. We're trying to find ways to stay globally engaged. So we're globally engaging the Africans. You know, it's a self-licking ice cream cone. They're, in a sense, begging the question. You know what? We know we have to invade Africa. Now we just have to figure out a reason why we're invading it. You know what I mean? Now we got, oh, look, this guy gave a rifle to that guy. Now they're linked together. And so now we can send squads here, there, and the other place. You know, they always deny they're in Nigeria, but then one of the generals confirmed to Nick Turse, we've lost guys fighting in Nigeria, you know, where they didn't report those casualties. This is, and much of the, almost all of this, and it's all in the book, this is the consequence of the war in Libya. The war in Libya spread jihadists down into Mali and all throughout West and Central Africa. And then that becomes the excuse to simply escalate and escalate and escalate. And so, you know, we got top tier and second tier special operations forces in Mali, in Niger, in Chad, in Central African Republic, in Sierra Leone, in Burkina Faso, Nigeria, Nigeria, the entire Lake Chad region there in the Sahel, you know, south of the Sahara Desert. And yeah, they want to go on like this forever. You know, we got troops in Mozambique now fighting against, you know, would-be bin Ladenites in Mozambique, which is, you know, in the southeast, adjacent to Madagascar, over there on the far side of the entire continent. And then they just announced a couple weeks ago they're sending troops into Congo. Pardon me, troops into Congo, which just means, yeah, drone strikes and assassination strikes. And, you know, most of these places, it means we're not invading and attacking the state government there. We're lying with the government against armed rebels in their country or in neighboring countries, right? So it's not like we're going and doing a regime change in Chad or a regime change in Niger. We're there with the permission at the behest of their governments to help keep whatever problems that they have down. But see, the thing is this, as you could well guess, right, that whatever, you know, rebels that you have, dissenters, armed groups fighting in Sierra Leone or fighting in Chad, well, they probably don't have much to do with bin Laden's philosophy, religion, or politics at all, right? These are local indigenous groups with their own local indigenous problems, such as they hate the current government and want to overthrow it. Well, as far as you know, or as far as I know, those armed groups are the good guys, and their governments are the ones who deserve overthrowing, right? And instead, we're backing the government against them, or the other way around. Maybe by backing the government against them, maybe they are the bad guys, but maybe by backing the government against them, we're only going to make them more powerful and discredit and destabilize the government we're supporting and end up leading to the bad guys taking over. And do you think that any idiot at Foggy Bottom up there in Washington, D.C. knows which horse to bet on in all of these things? And it's just, and you know, I need to learn a lot more about this, but there's really good writings about how all American and Western intervention led to the giant genocide in Rwanda of 1994 that they all then invoke to say we have to intervene everywhere in the name of humanitarianism. Because remember that one time we didn't and it was really, really bad? And yet right. That whole thing was a consequence. In fact, there's a great article you might remember last December. Tommy Raskin was the son of a congressman who wrote for us at antiwar.com. His father's a Democratic congressman. I forgot his first name. But he unfortunately committed suicide at the end of last year. But he had written this really, he was a really bright young man. He's like 25 years old or something. But he'd written this really great article for us at antiwar.com about how that was all America's fault in the first place, of course. You know, back screwing around there in the 1990s, supporting this dictator and that one. In Uganda and Rwanda and, you know, and that whole area, and Mobutu in Zaire, which then, you know, of course, when he finally was overthrown, was renamed the Democratic Republic of Congo again, or it was Congo before that. But anyway, so yeah. And, you know, look, this is what Donald Rumsfeld always wanted, Reed, was light and fast, get in, get out, kill the guys we want to kill. Sending special operators with rifles and laser designators, sending the Air Force behind them to obliterate anything that they point at, and then get the hell out and on to the next one. And, you know, if somebody has to remake something, let the UN do it. Let the State Department do it. And, you know, this was a big part of Rumsfeld's whole transformation of the military, was he didn't want large occupation forces with any intent to stay. He wanted light and fast, get in there and kill him and get the hell out. And I don't know if you know, but this is what got him fired in 2006, was he finally wanted out of Iraq. He said, look, at some point, they're going to have to figure this out for themselves. And if we favor one side or the other too much, we're going to end up, you know, setting the balance all wrong here. We should just quit now. And they said, you're fired, and brought in Robert Gates and did the surge, you know? But anyway, I mean, not that I'm sticking up for Rumsfeld. He was horrible, but I'm just saying that was his conception of things, was he wanted to, you know, I don't know how much he wanted to really scale down the army, but he didn't really want to use the army. He wanted to use special operations forces, but not like, you know, large scale infantry divisions marching around. And, but then, you know, of course, they'll say, yeah, the problem was he wanted to do occupations light and fast, but, you know, Bush had decided to stay, so we needed a much bigger and more robust occupation and program of reconstruction. All that. But that's all, you know, the wrong conclusion. And we shouldn't have gone at all is the right conclusion, you know. Right. But they'll end up blaming his light and fast doctrine when the mission wasn't for light and fast. The mission was for heavy occupation, but it shouldn't have been. It should have been neither, you know. But as far as the Senate Special Operations Forces and drone warriors, CIA drone warriors and special operations and Air Force drone warriors around the world, I mean, who's going to stop them, man? I don't know. Yep. And again, they are at the invitation, quote unquote, of many of these governments. They go in there. I'm sure they make them an offer they can't refuse. But they're not, again, they're not invading and fighting against these state governments like they were in the case of Libya, for example, which was a regime change against the central authority there. But like in Mali, they were fighting jihadists who were the consequences of the war in Libya and who were doing a regime change of their own that we were trying to undo, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you and I did a video like 6 or 7 months ago, the first time he came on here, episode 67, for those who are watching who want to go see it. And we talked about Rand Paul and Tulsi Gabbard and how they didn't really oppose the war on terrorism. They just opposed regime change wars. A clip came out of Tulsi Gabbard like a month ago or so. Dave did an episode on it where she was supporting drone strikes. And a lot of the reaction from people was, what happened? What did she suddenly flip on? But as you and I know, like, that's kind of always been the deal. She's always been against regime change wars, but supports killing terrorists. So my question is, I'm more of an advocate of ugly government. I like it when the government is blatantly authoritarian and obviously shitty, because then people oppose it. Whereas if the government is kind of this benevolent hand trying to help people, or at least people perceive it that way, then they're not as alert. They don't, I mean, if you look at like over the last year and a half, when they finally said they were going to do vaccine passports, that was the final straw for a lot of people. They were like, nope, you're not doing that over my dead body. And people actually started standing up and opposing what was going on. My question is, like, people like Tulsi Gabbard and Rand Paul, who oppose these regime change wars, but they support killing terrorists and targeted drone strikes, are they actually better, or are they more dangerous because they get a lot of supporters like me, and they kind of draw away from this deeper cancer that is taking place, and one that fewer people even realize is happening? Or what do you think about that?
No, I mean, I see what you're saying, but no, worse isn't better. Mm-hmm. You know, less worse is less worse, and we're stuck with that, but it is what it is. And to be clear about Tulsi Gabbard, for people who don't understand, to boil it down, the Obama government's policy in Syria was completely bananas. It was just insane. And, you know, on top of that, treasonous. But crazy is the more important part. I mean, they chose the bin Ladenites, the very worst factions from Iraq War II, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Zarqawi guys. And they remade them the mythical moderates in Syria and said, we like these guys better than Bashar al-Assad, the clean-shaven chin-wearing, three-piece suit-wearing dictator, secular dictator of the country, because he's allies with Iran. And even though it was the bin Ladenites that knocked our towers down, not Hezbollah and Iran, that's what our, you know, frankly, our Israel first government has as their priorities. And that goes, you know, especially we're talking about the Obama years here. And so they went for it. And in fact, honestly, there may be something to the idea that as crazy as this was at the time by the people who were saying it, there may have been a kernel of truth to the idea that Hillary Clinton and her staffers, like Huma Abedin, they were a bit sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood. And but the thing is, the Muslim Brotherhood in Qatar, they sit in the parliament. In Egypt, at least then, they were a bunch of rich old men, conservative old landowning doctors and lawyers and people like that. Whereas in Syria, they were pretty bad dudes. They're basically equivalent to the bin Ladenites in the war. And they were the basis of Ahrar al-Sham, which is essentially a bin Ladenite militia, no different than the worst of the other militias that fought in that war. But I think that there was an argument that, no, these guys aren't as bad as the Al-Qaeda guys or whatever. And this is something that I've noticed, you know, over and over throughout the years, people ascribe different reasons for it. But one thing is that when new developments take place, the government is so reluctant to revise their policy and revise the premises upon which their policy is based. So, you know, Reed, one day we're going to get rid of Assad and we're going to replace him with a government that's better and less worse, and that respects human rights and holds regular elections and doesn't commit such horrible violence against this population, whatever, right? Now then, I come to you in a few months and I go, actually, it turns out we really don't have any good guys to prop up. There's only bad guys everywhere. And so what do? Well, the answer is not admit that we were wrong 3 months ago. The answer is try harder. See what we can do. See if we can find some people that maybe can fit the bill and just keep going anyway. And then it'll be months and months or even years before they will make the adjustment to the policy, even when they know that they're wrong. And a huge part is just not being able to admit it, not being able to admit that, geez, you know, we talked ourselves into this, but we really shouldn't have done this. The same thing is part of what goes on with the war in Yemen, where you can find quotes from, it's Robert Malley, and what's the other guy's name? I quote him in the book. But Malley and his buddy, who they were both in the Obama government, they wrote an article for The Atlantic about how, geez, we're so sorry that we started this war in Yemen. And in fact, it's not that article. It's a different article where Malley's co-author on that article says something like, you know, it's really remarkable about, you know, just how not only the kind of strange way that we stumbled into this war in Yemen and supporting the Saudis in this war, but geez, it's also really kind of remarkable and weird how we were unable to stop, why we didn't correct it, why we didn't call the brakes and say, well, it's not working. Operation Decisive Storm, we're 2 years into it now. What are we going to do? Instead, we just let it go on autopilot, right? Same kind of thing in Syria. We're on the Iraqi side of the border, the bin Ladenites are the bad guys, and we just fought, and we're still fighting for the Shiites against the radical Sunni bin Ladenite, you know, the bin Ladenite edge of the Sunni insurgency there. But on the Syrian side of the line, the Shiites are the bad guys, and the Sunnis are the good guys no matter how bad they are. No matter if they suicide bomb schools full of little children, no matter if they behead people for refusing to convert from being Druze to whatever, you know, Salafi thing that they're pushing. You know, if they act like dictators in every town they take over and all of this stuff, they just refuse to admit that we should not be doing this. If we shouldn't be doing it now, then that would mean that we maybe shouldn't have been doing it the last few years too. We don't want to have to admit that. And so they just continue on. So anyway, I'm sorry to get to the point about Tulsi. Tulsi Gabbard was in the National Guard in Iraq War II, stationed in a medical unit at the Balad Air Base north of Baghdad during a period of really bad fighting, I think in 05 and 06, before the surge, but still. So this lady's seen her more than her share of guys screaming as they die, okay? She has seen war. You know, not pulling triggers, but she's seen the guys medevaced in there where others are trying very desperately to save their lives, crying for their mama and all of the worst part of the nightmare of war. She's seen all of that. Now, fast forward a few years, put her in Congress and tell her, the guys that blew up those guys that you saw die, they're the good guys now. They're moderate rebels and we like them. Well, for someone like her who knows the difference, she's just found this unacceptable. It's just crazy. You know, same thing for Mike Flynn. You know, Mike Flynn is an insane anti-Iran hawk. I mean, he's really a kook. He co-wrote a book with Michael Ledeen saying that, you know, Iran is leading an alliance of Iran and North Korea and Venezuela and what, Nicaragua against us, whatever it is now. You know, this is the new axis of evil in the world. This guy's bananas. And yet, ask him to support Al-Qaeda in Syria just because they're fighting against the Shiites who are friends with Iran? Nah, sorry, I pass. Right? And in fact, Seymour Hersh wrote about this. When Flynn was the head of the DIA, he was passing secret intelligence to the Germans to give to Assad to use to kill al-Nusra. He was essentially insubordinate against Obama's treason, saying, I won't go along with this. I'll undermine it. And was, again, passing intelligence to the Germans to give to Assad to kill the CIA's terrorists on the ground. That was when he's the head of the DIA. So that's the deal with Gabbard, too, is, you know, a war against anyone who could be associated in any way with the bin Ladenites. Yes, forever. A war against the secular dictator that empowers those same terrorists just because he's friends with the Ayatollah. Nah, no way. And so, but then that was the reality of the policy at the time. So that was why she was so quote unquote controversial at the time. Because she was upset about what was going on and she was complaining about it. But that made her the loudest anti-war voice in America, even though she was only against the insanity and the treason. She wasn't against the war against the bin Ladenites. And the reality is that I will concede to her is that there's probably more bin Ladenites now than ever before. The wars, you know, in the past 20 years have done nothing but create, you know, wide open spaces, and not just spaces, but battlefields for Al-Qaeda types to thrive in Iraq, in Libya, all across North Africa, into Syria and in Yemen. I mean, Reed, you hear me talk all the time about the war in Yemen. The war in Yemen is not the war against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The war in Yemen is the war for them.
Right.
Okay. But so now what happens when I get my magic wish and they finally stop bombing the Houthis and starving and genociding the population of that country, and Saudi leaves and UAE leaves? We've got Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula far more powerful than ever before. Who knows even how to measure it? At one point, they ruled 7 towns, including one major city, and their entire tax bases, seized military bases and weapons magazines. I mean, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, they had their own little mini state they've joined with the UAE's forces, you know, for public relations reasons, because it was, you know, about to backfire on them. They were doing too well. But even, man, I'm almost certain that even the New York Times said, and I phrase it that way quite deliberately, that this was an admission and a concession on their part. That it could have been Reuters, but I'm 99% sure it was even the New York Times said, well, you know, if the Al-Qaeda guys in Syria have a safe haven in the Idlib province, then the Al-Qaeda guys sure have, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula sure have a safe haven around the port city of Mukalla right now. So in other words, let's say, you know, forget my magic wish. Let's say Tulsi Gabbard gets her magic wish. So all of the regime change wars are canceled. We're not targeting the Shiites anymore. We're only targeting the bin Ladenites, but we are targeting the bin Ladenites, okay? That could be a major war for years to come. We have thousands of these guys right now in the Idlib province in Syria under Turkish protection, maybe tens of thousands of them. And I don't know how many we're gonna have of AQAP in the aftermath of the current war there. But it could be enough to justify essentially switching sides in the Yemen war again, back to whoever is fighting AQAP, possibly even backing the Houthis again against AQAP as they did in the beginning of 2015.
Yeah. So, I mean, I knew that this was the case, like with both Rand and Tulsi, and I supported both of them for president, but I don't think I realized how important it was, because I would say, like, oh, they're like 90% with us on war. They just disagree with the war on terrorism. But as time has gone on and I've listened to you, I've realized that it's pretty much 50%. It's not 90%. I mean, it's only halfway there, right?
That's right. And listen, I mean, I think it's also worth pointing out that, I'm sorry, I wish I remembered better what it was that she said in that stupid interview with Tucker. But I do know, and I mentioned this on your show before, that when she was running for president, oh, and someone asked me before, what's your source for that? The source is her Twitter feed. It was a video on her Twitter feed where she said, look, we have Al-Qaeda in the Idlib province. We have Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. We have Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Well, I'm sorry. We're already stretching quite a bit now, okay? Al-Shabaab is a local insurgency. Sometimes they shout the word Al-Qaeda out loud for a sack of gold coins from the Saudis or something. But they are not an internationalist bin Ladenite revolutionary group. I mean, they are a local indigenous problem at most. But she says, so we have Al-Qaeda in the Idlib province, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Shabaab in Somalia. And now she's out of groups. She's out. She can't name. I guess maybe she said, I don't even think she did say, but she probably could have said, well, and there's Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, supposedly in Algeria. Something like that. Some bin Ladenite tied groups in Libya. I don't know. Instead, she says, there are hundreds of these groups around the Middle East and Africa. And that's just a damn lie. And it's ridiculous. It was ridiculous when George W. Bush claimed that they were in 60 countries back when he launched this war. And there may be been more bin Ladenites now than ever before, but in 100 countries there are? And she wants to fight drone wars and special operations wars in all of them from now on? I mean, that's completely crazy. And it looks like your feed is frozen up there a little bit, but maybe it's just your video and not your audio. Can you remind me what all stupidity she was saying in that Tucker interview? Because I know he was bringing her on to set her up to be a dove, but that just didn't work out.
Yeah, can you hear me or am I not?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Go ahead.
All right.
Oh, yeah. There, you're froze too.
Okay. Yeah, this is what happens when I'm doing it from my truck. But yeah, he had her on to criticize the fact that no one had been fired and no one was being punished
over the Afghan withdrawal, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or I mean, just I think it was specifically the drone strike that happened. He was like, no one being fired or whatever. And then instead of saying, yeah, this is terrible, she gave like a 5-minute defense of drone strikes and saying, look, we can either do these regime change wars or we can target these Islamic extremists and, you know, take them out in a more, you know, more singular manner.
Right. I don't remember. And then that was the joke, right? Was she was there to address this drone strike that obliterated two families, seven children. And three adults. And all she could say was, yeah, targeted strikes like this are what we have to do.
Right.
You know, that's pretty bad.
Yeah.
And it goes to show, look, I got to tell you, too, people are really taken aback by that. Why? It's because the first time they paid attention to Afghanistan in 15 years. That's why. And the Americans have done nothing but bomb innocent people there. And, you know, for people who pay close attention to it, that was just one last atrocity on the way out. A pretty fitting ending to that. You know, atrocity, overall atrocity of a war. But these happen all the time, Reed. And, you know, there's two Jack Murphys on Twitter. One of them has that big beard with the different colors. And the other one does not have a big beard. He's the special operations guy, former Green Beret. And he used to write for Soft Rep, which is like Special Operations Forces. I don't know what rep stood for. Anyway, he writes for... crap. I'd have to find it, man. I'm sorry. I can't remember the name of the publication anymore. But I just interviewed him back 3-4 weeks ago, okay? And what had happened was, I think I told you before probably, when Trump came in, he wanted to end the war in Afghanistan, but they made him escalate instead. And he did. He escalated the air war massively. And he canceled any restrictions that the Obama people had put on, which were very few. I mean, the number of innocent people killed in the Obama years based on how loose their restrictions were then is legendary. Then Trump comes in and cancels every restriction that he can under the law. And not only that, but he delegates the authority to call in airstrikes all the way down the chain of command as low as allowed by law to, I don't know, captains or colonels or whatever it was, where before it had to be a 2-star general to give the okay. Something like that. And we already knew that. And there's a great article by Anand Gopal called The Other Afghan Women in The New Yorker that just came out recently, where he describes from the point of view of the women of Helmand Province, what it's like to be bombed by the Americans for the last 20 years like this, and all the people that they've lost, all the innocent people that they've lost. You know, my cousin and his brother and the thing and on down the line, you know. But then so Jack Murphy has this piece where his sources are the drone operators. His sources are the Army guys or the, you know, Air Force guys and I don't know, CIA or whoever who are talking to him. They're the ones pulling the triggers. They're the ones killing people in the Helmand province. And they're telling him, man, all we do is kill innocent people. Two guys walking down the street. Oh, that's suspicious. You're dead. There's no phones anywhere. No cell phone towers. No phone lines anywhere. The only way anybody can communicate is by CB radio or by walkie-talkie. Well, if you see something, we're talking about drone pilots now. If you see something that looks like it could be an antenna, kill them. An antenna means Taliban, right? And we already know from when they had the place crawling with soldiers that their intel was absolute garbage. Speaking of Mike Flynn, Mike Flynn said, there's no point in having a drone war when we don't have any good intelligence who we're killing. And that's why we need a big surge. Then we'll know who we're killing. Well, that was not the right answer, but he was right about the problem. We don't even know who we're killing. And then when we do that, we're killing innocent people. We're driving people right into the arms of the insurgency. He derided it as, instead of counterinsurgency, merely anti-insurgency, which is ignorant and stupid and counterproductive. You know, you can read that. It's a big report he wrote on the lack of intelligence in Afghanistan. It's at the Center for New American Security website. But anyway, he was right about that, that they had no intelligence, you know, worth a damn. They were killing people based on this guy's SIM card was once in contact with this guy's SIM card was once in contact with this guy's SIM card. So it's just like playing, you know, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, which I don't know if you know this, but I saw a cool thing on the Discovery Channel years ago about how they figured out with this link analysis that read everyone in the world is 6 degrees away from from Kevin Bacon. Now, it's not just actors who've been in movies with actors who've been in other movies every human on the planet is within 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. We all are. So now, if you're just a kook, especially if you're an army kook with a computer, then you can just draw. You know, there used to be this website, Global Research. Oh, it's still around. I think it was Global Research that had a tool where it just had lines, intersecting lines showing powerful relationships between different people and institutions and whatever. But they don't really tell you what the lines mean or how strong these connections are. Maybe these people are enemies with each other. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You can look at it however you want. Well, that's how the army does it. They essentially have conspiracy theory computer programs that pretend to impart like important knowledge or meaning behind connections between cell phones. But it's just bullshit, man. It's not even knowledge. It's just data. Right? It's not even information. It's just data. And they treat it as though it's not just knowledge, but intelligence, which means it's really smart. And you can't ever call it stupid because it has intelligence right in the name. We have this intelligence that says that this phone talked to this phone, talked to this phone, and this guy we think is a Taliban. So then we kill all of them. Yeah. And it's just innocent people. And that's how the war's been for years and years and years, for 20 years. And, you know, I mentioned a bare few number of atrocities in my book, maybe like 5 or 8 in Fool's Errand. And I have people complain that there's a gratuitous amount of blood and violence in this book. Like, fine, fine, we got the point. Sometimes innocent people get killed. But like, well, geez, I don't know. That's pretty important. It's kind of the point. They say that they're fighting this war to help these people. But how many of them can you kill before you know, that's no longer even partially plausible? You know, there was one where a helicopter gunship, I guess an Apache, killed these 8 boys who were out looking for firewood, you know, collecting firewood. And one of them survived because a limb from a tree fell on him and essentially concealed him. So they blew away everybody else. And then this little boy lived and told the story about it. And I was thinking about that. I've talked about this before, I guess. But I remember when that happened, you know, when it first happened, that story first came out. And I was counting them up. And I was thinking that 8 boys, that would be me and all the boys in the neighborhood where I grew up. You know, all of my friends on my street and the next street and two streets over, the kids I skated with, their brothers and whatever, right? Like this very few, this was essentially like, what would it have meant for me and my eight closest friends in the neighborhood, us boys, to all get obliterated by a helicopter gunship while we were out innocently looking for firewood, right? And what would that have done to our families? What would that have done to our neighborhood? Who would the survivors have been? Who would my mom and dad be after me and the boys all got shot up by a helicopter, right?
Radical.
How could they go on? How could these families survive that? What is their life now? But that's just another day of the war in Afghanistan. It was like that for 20 years. But somehow, oh no, come on, we mean well. We're just here because we love you so much. We're not here to punish you. We thought those were bad guys. We were protecting you from them. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
You know, as long as I'm rambling, I got another. I think I might have told you this one too. I'm sorry if I'm so repetitive, but I know a guy, Frank Ledwidge, who is Her Majesty's Royal Navy intelligence officer from the UK, was stationed down there in the Helmand province. And he told me that an Afghan asked him, "What are you guys doing here? Why are you even here?" And he said, "Well, some Arabs crashed a plane in a village called New York, in a valley far away from here." And the guy says, "What does that have to do with me?"
Yeah.
Right? Like, for anybody who's familiar with a map, the Arabs are all from 1,000 miles west of Afghanistan. Okay. On the other side of Persia from Afghanistan is where the Arabs can be found. Right. This poor Pashtun in the Helmand province has never seen an Arab in his life. Right. It's like ask him if, you know, about an Eskimo or something. Right. He doesn't know what that is.
Yeah.
And even just think about it. He has to tell him a village called New York, because one, the guy's never heard of New York, the most important city in the world. And two, he's never heard of a city.
Yeah.
He can only tell him it's a village because the guy doesn't have a concept of what a town is, much less what a city is, much less what New York is, or the New World on which East Coast it sits, right? This guy has no clue. And then to go along with that, I just saw this a few weeks ago. I tweeted about it. You know, if anybody was patient enough to go trolling through my thing back a couple of weeks, you could probably find it, where it's a Brit shows pictures, like high quality printout laminated copies of the September 11th attacks. The planes crashing, the towers burning and collapsing. And he shows them to first these two young farmers. They're like in their 20s. And this young Afghan farmer, he goes, "I have no idea what I'm looking at. I mean, I got to tell you, lady," he goes, "listen, all I know is I put seeds in the ground and then I try to like turn it into a plant to eat. And I have to tell you, like, I'm sorry. That's all I know." Mm-hmm. "I don't know any other things. I don't know about the world. I don't know." And he was telling the God's honest truth. The extent of his knowledge was his property and put water on a seed and some sunshine and hope that you have something to eat later. And that was it, right? Yeah. This guy has been living in total deprivation of every kind his entire life. He has no idea. He's at pains to try to explain to the lady with the camera that "I don't know what you're talking about. In fact, like, I don't know anything at all." Then they show the same pictures to some village elders. And the village elder, this is in the Helmand province in the south. And the village elders are looking at the pictures. And they're just completely flabbergasted. They have no idea. Okay, they're looking at Manhattan. And they're like, "What is this?" And one of the old men says, "I think maybe it's Kabul." Right? These guys have no conception whatsoever of what the capital city of their country looks like at all. They've never seen a picture of Kabul. I have to tell you, I've never been to Kabul, but I've seen some pictures of it, and I can tell you it doesn't look the first thing like Manhattan, even 20 years ago, okay? This is the most technologically sophisticated place that's ever existed in downtown Manhattan. Everything, steel and glass, every bit of it. There's no mud. There's no buildings made out of, you know, homemade crap. This is a megalopolis. This is the center of everything. And these old men go, maybe Kabul? And now here's the point. The point is, that's okay, Reed, because we're not there to punish them for September 11th, right? The poll says that 92% of the Afghans have never heard of 9/11. 92% have never heard of it, have no idea what it even is. No Afghans were involved in it, so makes sense. But we're not there to punish them for that. We're there to help them because the poor dears were enslaved by the Taliban. Yes, Bill Clinton helped support the rise of the Taliban 5 years before the regime change in 1996. But never you mind that. We decided that they're really, really bad guys. And now, not only are we going to overthrow them, but we're going to fight a war for 20 years to back whoever is friends with the people we put in power in Kabul. And if that means the very worst warlords, back to that Anand Gopal piece in The New Yorker, everyone should really read this. It's really, really good, dude. You really like it. Make your computer read it out loud to you while you're driving. It's called The Other Afghan Women. And, you know, where they talk about this. He interviews these people in great detail about what their lives have been like down there in the Helmand province. And one of them was about how there's this terrible warlord that the Taliban came and removed. And they were so grateful. And they didn't like the Taliban either. But God, at least they got rid of that one guy. And then the Americans come and put him back. And the guy's just a ruthless war criminal, drug dealer, child rapist, monster. And all over the country, it's the same story over and over and over again. The Americans come and take the very worst people and put them in power. And then so no wonder people prefer the Taliban to some guy who kidnaps and rapes their children. What do they think they're doing? You know, other than prolonging the thing and cashing checks. But as far as like accomplishing their mission, you know, creating a new government made of people who were so evil, they made the Taliban look like heroes when they came to town to get rid of them. So yeah. I'm sorry, I'm just ranting. But the point being that people got really upset about that drone strike, not because, oh, the poor victims, but just because of the incompetence and how bad it looked. It was embarrassing for America that that was part of our embarrassing withdrawal. But that's the name of the war. That's the nature of the war we've been fighting this whole time, you know, is ultimate brutality.
Yeah. You got time for one last question or you got to run?
Sure. Yeah.
So I met you at Freedom Fest. That was great. And I watched in person your debate with Ayaan Hirsi Ali. And I'm an atheist. I used to be a Christian, but she was one of the people I sort of listened to who started making me question all that. And then other people like Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens. What I find ironic is that so many of these people who hate Islamic extremism, they support these policies that create Islamic extremism. And I know you're also, I don't know if you're an atheist, but I know you're not a religious person. Do you find that aggravating at all? Because there are all these like great Christians who are anti-war and, you know, all over the place. But a lot of these atheist speakers, they're just really, they've bought this neocon dogma hook, line, and sinker. I just wanted to hear what you think about that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I am an atheist. I've never believed in any religion at all. It's all ridiculous to me. No offense to people who believe in it, but I don't believe in it even a little. But I hate all the new atheists. I hate Christopher Hitchens. Glad he's dead. And I'm not impressed whatsoever by Dawkins or Harris or any of these guys. I mean, for Christ's sake, I figured this out that, yeah, mythology is mythology in third grade. And I was over resenting Christians for being like overbearing Baptists trying to save my soul and whatever by the time I was like in 10th grade. Because, I mean, I don't know. I guess I look at it like there people have a lot of people have very good reasons to believe what they believe. And I believe in liberty first, and it's kind of none of my business. And especially I know a lot of people have faith because they got nothing else. You know, their lives have been completely ruined by people or by happenstance or whatever it is. And the only thing they got left in the world is their faith. So I don't ever want to get between people and their beliefs. You know, I'm not about that. And I always really resent that about all of these, you know, atheist industry types and I see the harm that it does to people in some ways too, but I think it's probably overall it's more good than harm. And I definitely don't see the good in trying to separate regular powerless people from their faith, you know? So that's my first point about all of that kind of thing. Then secondly, as you're kind of indicating here, look how cynical this all is, you know? Religion is so bad. It's so bad. Especially Islam. Really, huh? Well, Allah is just Yahweh. How come I don't hear Bill Maher going on and on about how stupid and horrible Judaism is? You know, yeah. He only picks on Christians and especially Muslims. Same for Harris and Hitchens. You know, Hitchens was good on Palestine for a long time. I don't know if he ever, you know, really focused on the religious excuses for the frauds and the violence perpetrated on the Palestinian people there. But it seems like it's really easy to pick on Muslims when you're in a supermajority country fighting a war on behalf of the Jewish state. And you go, oh, yeah. You know who's really bad? People who believe in the religion that's the supermajority religion of the countries that we're bombing right now. You know, I mean, give me a break. You know, if you read The Clean Break by David Wormser, the neocons' plan for why we need to get rid of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the reason why is because we want to steal the West Bank. We don't want to have to give up the West Bank. And if we can, and Gaza too, but especially the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And if we can, you know, finagle a position of strength in the region, stronger than we have now, then we won't have to give up the West Bank. We can have our cake and eat it too, and screw everybody else. Now, you ever heard Bill Maher do an episode of the show where he talked about how absolutely insane that is?
Nope.
That these people believe in this absolutely ridiculous mythology about Abraham and Solomon and Moses, and that there's this ancient promise that says a bunch of Russians get to steal and own Palestine and take it from who? From the people who are actually the descendants of the ancient Hebrews? Get the hell out of here. He doesn't ever say that. He doesn't ever say Judea and Sumeria. It's the West Bank and it's private property. Get off. You don't ever hear him say that. You don't ever hear him attack the Jewish God. You hear him attack Christians, but he doesn't attack Episcopalians with power, right? He attacks poor Baptist redneck fools who believe in the prosperity gospel or whatever it is. But he doesn't attack power. That's the same with all of them, man. And you know, frankly, I think all it is really just dressed up Zionism. You know, I think that's what it is. And remember, Israel was founded by secular communists, mostly. They didn't believe that God gave them that land. They just believed that they could take it. And what are you going to do about it? But you don't have to be religious to be a Zionist. You know, it helps, though, if you need a supernatural rationalization for violating the purely obvious natural rights of the people who you're confiscating property from and ruthlessly persecuting and killing and lying about all the time, bearing false witness against constantly, you know. And so, yeah. And look, I mean, I think Islam is, as a derivative of Judaism and Christianity, is also ridiculous. Like all of it is. But you know, so are ancient Chinese dragons and Gilgamesh and Zeus and Athena and all ancient mythology. It's all whatever the Mayan gods. Those are the one true gods, right? It's, you know, whatever. I don't take, so I don't mean to sound like I'm more anti-Jewish, because I'm not. I'm just, you know, I'm not a monotheist, but I'm not a Hindu either. I don't believe in any of this stuff. And I do think that it's plainly cynical that these professional, you know, anti-religionists, as they fashion themselves, almost exclusively pick on Muslims when they're the ones on the receiving end. You know what I mean? In fact, yeah. I mentioned that Daniel McAdams interview today. I love Daniel McAdams. And in that interview, he talks about, he calls it the Lou Rockwell rule, about just don't repeat CIA talking points, right? Don't demonize your government's enemies. You know, sure, there are plenty of problems with Islam and with Islamic societies and whatever. But right now, your government is collecting excuses for bombing them. You don't need to help to participate in that. It's the same thing like with North Korea. Ooh, North Korea is a common tyranny. Yeah, I know. Guess what? So does everybody else already know that. So all you're doing is chiming in and helping out when the American Empire is demonizing one of their official enemies, and they don't need, you know, your support. It's the same kind of thing here. And in fact, as I said, I think in my debate with Hirsa Ali, that or in that panel discussion, that look, we would be, there are plenty of things about the Muslim world that if we believe in natural rights as we do as libertarians, that we would love to lecture some Muslim countries on for their terrible violations of human rights. Just because we don't believe in intervention doesn't mean we don't believe that other people in the world don't have the right to be free, especially to be free of torture, to be free of killing and dispossession and all of these things, to be free of, for example, religious persecution. And so it would be great if we could focus on criticizing countries who are falling short in those ways without being the world's worst hypocrites on the issue, and just take like the last 20 years as a counterfactual. Like, what if it had been Harry Brown and not W. Bush? What if Harry Brown had sent the Delta Force to kill bin Laden by the end of 01, and then the entire war on terrorism was over? And all he did was bring all of our troops home and all of our ships home and all of our planes home, abandon the world empire, and then from a position of not hypocrisy, lecture the world about how we're doing our best every single day to have a society of liberty here. And the rest of the world, you ought to all try to be like us. Look at what a great job we're doing. And in Pakistan, you guys need to respect freedom of religion better. And in Afghanistan, you guys need to stop raping little kids. And in Somalia, where Hirsa Ali is from, you need to stop with the FGM. And that's a big thing among the Kurds as well. That the rest of humanity has figured this out. You're doing it wrong. And if we have to ridicule you to death until you stop, we will. But we're not going to mass murder you at the same time we're lecturing you for falling short on human rights, because then that would look really hypocritical and cynical and stupid, wouldn't it? And so I really believe that, man. I have to say, like, when I play back the counterfactual of the last 20 years of a Harry Brownian foreign policy, I could see, quite easily that, you know, obviously there would be some reactions in some places and whatever, but that overall liberty around the world would be advancing. Self-government, and I'm not a big fan of democracy for all it entails, but regular elections are a big improvement on not having regular elections in, you know, 999 out of 1,000 nations. And respect for liberty and respect for the American principles of natural rights and individual liberty, the way of the Declaration of Independence and the rest of the American creed and the libertarian creed, that I think that would all be doing so much better all around the world. You know, look at how they say, well, we thought if we helped China get rich, that then they would adopt liberty and democracy and stuff like us. Well, you know what? Maybe that was working, and maybe the war on terrorism is what short-circuited it. right? Maybe the war on terrorism made the Americans look like such bloody, corrupt hypocrites that they just made all of that freedom and liberty stuff into just a joke. It's nothing but like a marketing slogan anymore. Nobody believes it anymore. Nobody takes it to heart anymore. And the people of China, the ruling elite especially, but the people in general, like, what reason do they have to take anything the Americans say to heart? Freedom and liberty. Hey, you guys just got finished killing 2 million people who didn't attack you. 2 million people who did nothing to you. How could anybody in the world think that, yeah, the Americans, they're the ones who really got their act together, and that's who we need to follow? And that's who, you know, that was why in the debate with Chris, I was trying to attack the neocon from the neocon. Well, and frankly, for that matter, in the debate with Hirsch Salih, I was trying to say, if you want to spread liberty to the world, the last thing in the world you want to do is lead with violent military force. It just doesn't make sense. You want people to accept liberty, you're going to have to sell them the idea on the open market for a reasonable price that they'll be willing to pay. Otherwise, it's just not going to take. Simple as that. And, you know, I heard, again, the McAdams interview, it was something Dice said about one of the problems is, he's almost paraphrasing me from the debate with Crystal. And in fact, I cut this line. It was too long and I had to cut for time. And I went over time anyway. But I had a line in there about part of the problem is the neoconservative. Oh, I did say this part. The neoconservatives and their neoliberal counterparts never really understood what liberty was about in the first place. They have this weird, twisted conception of it. And so then they get it all wrong in the way that they try to export it, you know. But I did have a line before that where I quoted his father's book, Two Cheers for Capitalism, Irving Kristol's book, that, you know, these were guys who never really understood natural rights, individual liberty, free market economics, any of this stuff. They've all been, you know, essentially kept house intellectual, court intellectual, think tanker types this whole time. So they never really understood liberty. So they didn't even realize what hypocrites they were being in using all of this violent force in the name of freedom and self-rule. To them, that's just how it's done. And there wasn't anyone there to say to them that this is the fatal flaw in your program here, you know, which, by the way, I think a lot of that was cynical in the first place. But there was, you know, to a degree, they believed that they could do anything, and that if they could help to spread self-government to more nations, then the people there would be grateful and would be pro-American after that. You know, I think there was quite a bit of that belief there on their part.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining me tonight, Scott. It's always great talking to you. I know your book, Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism, is coming out on audio soon, right? And a lot of my trucker friends will like that. So I don't know if you want to plug anything before we end or...
Yeah. So it's fun drive time right now at the Libertarian Institute. That's me and Pete Quinones and Kyle Anzalone, along with Tommy Salmons and Keith Knight and Patrick McFarlane. All of us podcasters, but also then we got these great writers, Kim Robinson and Connor Freeman and Lori Calhoun and Jim Bovard, and put together a great site for you every day at libertarianinstitute.org. And then I'm the editorial director. Oh, I should say I'm the director of the Libertarian Institute. I'm the editorial director of antiwar.com, which I urge people to read every single day, especially Jason Ditz and Dave DeCamp and their news summaries every single day. And we got great, you know, all of the best in-house writers as a regular columnist there. And then, yes, you're right. My audiobook is coming out soon. I still got to go over. There are a few errors in there that still got to get cleaned up. But I'm really, really, really shooting hard for the end of this week. I plan on having that up for you guys. Yeah, I'll leave it at that. Oh, and I got a show. I've done 5,600 and something interviews. And you can sign up for the podcast feed there at scotthorton.org. And at my YouTube channel is youtube.com/ScottHortonShow.
All right. Well, thanks, Scott. Everyone watching, look in the description. I've got links to some of the stuff Scott mentioned and also my Odyssey channel, if you can subscribe to me there, because I don't know how much longer I'll be on YouTube. Thanks for watching. I will be live streaming tomorrow night with Sal the Agorist at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. So check in for that. And thanks again, Scott.
Thank you.